I'm ready.
Joint Committee on Tax Credits will come to order. We are operating on a bit of a skeleton crew at the moment, but folks will come in. And I'm going to open a public hearing on, continue the public hearing on House Bill 3582. And where we last left this in our previous episode, we were about to call up a panel of, if they are here, Mark Pangborn, Elaine Wells, and David Williams.
Good morning, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Mark Pangborn. I am the general manager for the Lane Transit District in Eugene, Springfield, as well as the chair of the Oregon Transit Association. So I appreciate the opportunity to share with the committee how critical and vital the BETSI program has become for transit throughout the entire state of Oregon. Although relatively new, the program has become a very, very important stream of financing for transit services throughout the state. You wonder how you get there. We're under what I think is now called the CONI, or the conservation part of the legislation, and there's a subset for transportation. Within that, there are three primary areas that transit has been involved with. Actually, four, if you say. I had some stuff here. I got focused on the testimony. Yeah, you'll be able to see that in front of you. There's three primary sources of that this BETSI funds go to. The first is an employer pass program. The second is what we call the student pass, and the third is elderly and disabled and rural transit benefits. And I have two colleagues with me that will talk about those last two parts. The first part, the employer pass program, came out of a program that is primarily in the Portland metropolitan area, Salem, and in Eugene, which is an employer pass program where employers are able to take a tax credit for purchasing bus passes for their employees. And this is really focused on getting commuter employees to use public transit to get to and from work. And it's been very, very successful. If you look on the chart there, TriMet has over 70,000 employees in the area who are eligible, have passes that have been purchased by their employers in the area. In Eugene, we have over 45 employers who have purchased bus passes for their employees. And it has a significant impact in getting more and more people onto the system and transferring. Of course, then reducing vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas emissions within those communities. There is also another piece of the program that's not listed here, which is a subsidy for transit districts to purchase fuel-efficient vehicles, particularly the new hybrid buses that are coming in. And so what's really interesting about this, it's been a key piece because the federal government has put up 80% of the funding for purchasing these vehicles, but requires the local transit districts to put up the other 20% match. Particularly for the smaller systems, they do not have the local match, so they're not able to upgrade their system to hybrid electric. But this money, because it's state money and it's local, can be used as match to the federal, so it has been very effective in terms of leveraging federal funds for more fuel-efficient vehicles. So that's the two parts of the program. I would ask Elaine Wells, who can introduce herself and talk about the program that deals with elderly and disabled and the small transit systems.
Co-chairs and committee members, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to share information with you. I am Elaine Wells, the Executive Director of Ride Connection in Portland. I'm here today on behalf of your constituents to talk to you about the crucial funding Ride Connection and many transit providers throughout the state receive from the Business Energy Tax Credits Conservation Program. I urge you, well, actually, I'm here to plead with you to continue this funding. BETSI funding is critical to many of your constituents, both business and individual constituents, who depend on us for their mobility and independence. Without BETSI funds, we and all the other agencies that receive the funding will have to cut services. If it were not for Betsy, we would have been able to provide at least 90,000 trips this last fiscal year, and that's a conservative number. This means that individuals may not live an independent life, be consumers in their communities by purchasing goods from their local stores, get to medical appointments, find and retain employment. Georgia lost her driver's license a year ago due to an auto accident and has no family available to take her places. Because of access to transportation, she can maintain her independence by getting to her medical appointments and the more immediate needs, like grocery shopping. Because of transportation services, she maintains a quality of life that allows her to remain active in her community. She is every adult in every community. She is you and me when we get older and can no longer drive. Ride Connection is a 25-year-old nonprofit organization that provides transportation options for older adults, people with disabilities, rural residents, and low-income job seekers and wage earners in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. We provide these services through a network of human service partners. Last year, we provided over 393 trips and assisted another 2,000 individuals on how to safely and independently access public transit. Ride Connection has utilized Betsy funding to leverage and match $2.3 million in federal funds since its inception. These funds, like the other funds that other transit agencies have leveraged, are used to provide the essential transportation services to many of your constituents. Without a source of funding like Betsy, we would have to turn back federal funding because of not having the local match available to us. The economic ramifications would also be great if Betsy was not continued at its current level. Ride Connection employs 43 individuals with 34 people at a livable wage level, and that's figured at twice the state's minimum wage. In addition, over 43,000 trips, or 11% of our service, are for individuals to access work and work-related activities. Without Betsy funding, the cuts and economic impact would be significant. Many rural providers would be affected. For example, in the city of Canby, if Betsy funding is eliminated, the general manager would have to recommend to the city council that they eliminate their fixed route service and only provide commuter service in the morning and evening hours and provide the bare minimum to older adults and people with disabilities. So I urge you to allow transit services to continue to receive funding through Betsy until a sustainable funding source for transit is secured. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, and for Mr. Williams and for everybody who will be coming up and testifying, we have a lot of people to get through. So if you could please limit your comments to 3 minutes at most, 2 minutes is an A, that'd be fantastic.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with Portland Public Schools. I guess if 2 minutes is an A, I'll try to get it to an A+, so we'll see what we can do. To talk about the leveraging of the business energy tax credit for a unique transportation for kids in the state of Oregon, and particularly in Portland Public Schools, we have managed to create what we think is a pretty unique and a very effective model for providing transportation to the students of Portland Public Schools, and specifically to our high school age students. Through the partnership of the Betsy program, we are able to provide transit passes to every single high school student in the district. Prior to this, of course, that we provide transit passes for high school students for which the mandate for transportation applies, and these would be our low-income students, NCLB-eligible students, and students who live outside of the mile-and-a-half walk zones for high schools. That's about 3,000 kids. We're able, because of this program, to provide transit passes to 13,000 kids. Now, this may sound like, to some, maybe a frivolous expansion or an unnecessary expansion of the transit pass programs. Obviously, a nice win for a lot of kids. But there's also a very significant financial benefit here as well. Providing these transit passes using this financial means is highly cost-effective for the district. If we were to provide traditional yellow bus services for all of the eligible kids, not every high school kid, but just kids who are eligible to receive transportation services from the district, we estimate that the cost would be in excess of $6 million. So what we're looking at is about a $4.2 million hit to the state school fund, because, of course, 70% of that is matched. So that's direct appropriation from the state. And the remainder comes out of the district general fund, which, of course, as you all are acutely aware, is by and large a direct appropriation from the state as well. Whereas this program allows us to leverage and expend $3.5 million. So you're looking at a difference from $6 million down to $3.5 million. So it's not just that this is a great ability to deliver transit to a whole generation of users in Portland and really help kids beyond the education day, because these passes are, of course, good 24-7 throughout the school year. It's a 10-month pass. But it is an ability for us to have a more cost-effective means of delivering transportation to kids in the district. I'll just add to that that we are not the only district doing this. While not statewide, this program is being utilized by students in Salem-Keizer Public Schools, as well as the Eugene and Bethel school districts via the Lane Transit District. So it's a very effective method for kids living in our urbanized areas to take advantage of transit.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Gelser.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for coming today and speaking so eloquently about the importance of transportation. If you can't get where you need to go, you can't do very much, whether that's school or work or anything else. One of the questions I have about this, though, is whether or not we lose focus on the importance of transportation, our transportation funding needs, when we fund it through a back door like this. And I appreciate that you're able to leverage other resources and it's less costly to collaborate with the city to use the city bus passes. But if we were to give you just a direct appropriation rather than running this through a tax credit, couldn't you still work with your local transit agency to buy the bus passes? And might it not be more administratively simple to just simply directly appropriate transportation funds rather than going through a kind of convoluted tax credit process?
Chair Bailey, Representative Gelser, excellent question. I think that there are sort of a number of reasons why this is taking place in the Betsy program. Obviously, it's a nexus of opportunity. Districts, as you know, are significantly underfunded in this state and looking for every available opportunity to leverage resources to provide services to kids. And this happened to be one that existed at the time. We leverage many other funding streams and opportunities for a wide variety of circumstances. The question of a direct appropriation, I think, whatever ability we have to deliver this program, in your infinite wisdom to deliver, we would take advantage of. If that's a direct appropriation, I think we'd be more than happy to take advantage of a direct appropriation. I think, when we look at the climate we're in right now, granted, direct appropriation versus tax credit is still revenue that comes off of your ledger, so I understand that dynamic acutely. But we see this as the best available opportunity at the moment. When we're ready to have that conversation in ways and means about a direct appropriation on that, we will certainly be at that table as well.
Great, thank you. And just as a quick follow-up, I think you're correct that our schools are grossly underfunded. Our cities and counties struggle as well. And I think anything this committee and Oregonians can do to address our broken property tax system so that local governments, including school districts, cities, and counties, have the ability to pay for basic services with their communities making those choices would be a very smart thing and help us avoid some of these creative ways to get around the problems that we've created on the ballot.
Agreed. Thank you.
Gutcher Berger.
Yes, I will be very brief, Mr. Chair, because I have delved into this transit, Betsy, pretty thoroughly over this session, and I want to kind of make some points here. So Sir, when in your handout, you mentioned that overall 70,000 employees receive passes from employers on TriMet Transit Pass program. It's a great program, but as the funder of it, because this is state funding through a Betsy program that bleeds money off the top, in other words, it isn't a direct appropriation, and it costs us more than you get in services because of the way that it works. And yet I have no way, and maybe the transit people have a way of knowing, you give a transit pass, you don't have a feedback loop that says it was actually used, do you? I mean, maybe you do.
Yeah, I can't speak for TriMet, but we do in Eugene. We actually, on an annual basis, every one of the companies that are buying the pass, we survey those employees. We work with the companies to see how many are actually using. Actually, the companies, it costs them. They don't get a free ride on this. It still costs the company, even with the Betsy tax credit, to buy this pass. So they want to be sure that, in fact, it's serving their employees as well. And I would point out that, in fact, getting more people on the bus does meet a couple state mandates in terms of reduction of greenhouse gases.
I understand that.
I want to move on.
And what I would really like from you is what your feedback loop is and what TriMet's feedback loop is, because I understand the need fully. But where is the how much energy we've saved, or have we just supported your budgets through the wrong way to support your budgets is what I mean. I appreciate that we're all in deep trouble here in terms of our budgets and the services we're providing, and the services that you are providing are important ones. But what are we buying, and how can we monitor it is an important question in here, and that's what I want. Where's the feedback? You offer a pass. The school kids, how many are you monitoring exactly how many school kids are using this to get to school, or are they just using it to play around downtown? I mean, do I know that? These are the questions that I would like more details on if you have them available, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move on.
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are somewhat related to that issue. And I think I want to pick on Portland for a minute, mostly because that's whose information I have in front of me. I'm looking at the material provided by Mr. Williams. You indicate in your third bullet point that about 3,000 students used the program at some point earlier, and 13,000 students do now. Are these all the students who are eligible for riding the bus? Or are these students? Are these, how do you figure out which 13,000 students get this
right
pass?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, thanks for the question. To clarify, the 3,000 students are roughly the number of high school kids who are eligible for transportation under the state's transportation mandate and No Child Left Behind transportation requirements. 13,000 is approximately the number of high school kids in Portland Public Schools. Because of the Betsy program, we are able to provide transit passes to every single high school kid in the district, which is that additional 10,000 increment above the eligible students. The eligible students previously were receiving transportation and transit passes not as a result of the Betsy program. We were using existing funds, state school fund, transportation grant dollars, et cetera. We are still utilizing those funding streams, transportation grant and general fund dollars, and leveraging the Betsy to expand the program.
Okay. Follow up. So a student who lived 400 feet from a high school would still get a transit pass if they asked for it.
Under this current program,
under the current program,
yes.
Follow up, if I may. Different, a slightly different topic.
We do need to move on fairly quickly.
Yes. You've described that this program is the efficient way of doing it. That would be true regardless of how it's funded, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think, in essence, the similar question to what Representative Gelser asked, would it be efficient under, say, a direct appropriation? I think absolutely. It certainly would be.
That's a different question than what I'm asking. You said you used to spend these number of dollars, and now you're spending this number less.
Right.
Total, wherever the money comes from. That would still be true regardless of where the money came from, wouldn't it?
If we were to run this program of transit passes for all high school kids, all high school students in PPS, is that? I guess I'm having a little hard time tracking the question.
All I'm dealing with, if I could, Mr. Chair, again, is to say you said you spend you used to spend this much.
Correct.
And now, total, you spend less.
Correct.
That would still be true regardless of where the money comes from.
I suppose, absolutely, yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser, very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, can I borrow that for a second? If it was a direct appropriation, even though you might have the same amount of money, building on Representative Berger's point, this $25 million in services is costing the state about $35 million. But the second piece of my question is, if you were receiving a direct appropriation and you were looking at how best to serve your high school students, might you not decide that those dollars were better spent allowing all of your high school students to attend high school all day rather than to provide a bus pass to students that live a couple hundred feet from a high school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, also a very excellent question. I would imagine that in the calculus that our board goes through in developing a budget for the school year, there are many trade-offs. And if this were simply added to the state school fund as additional funds, one could very easily see the step taken to provide a different mix of services rather than focusing this on transit buses.
So just in sum, as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, this is a nice thing to have, but it is not the most essential thing for students in Portland Public Schools.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I'm not willing to say that. I think kids getting to school, kids being able to move around the district to access various alternative programs, kids being able to get to after-school jobs or internships or any variety of things can be, for that kid, the most meaningful part of their school day. And it may be something that, on a macro level, the district were to choose not to fund. But for that kid, it may mean the difference between staying in school or dropping out. So it's hard to say whether or not this is more important or less important. I think, as you know, boards make a very variety of decisions when it comes to budgeting on a local level. And it's hard to say that this is more important or less important than any other part of the school day.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you to this panel. I'd like to call up Chris Fick, Dan Eisenbeiss, and Jim Mitchell. And on deck, we'll have Craig Strobeck, Sean Sosnovec, and Doris Penwell.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bailey, other members of the committee. I'm Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is strongly supportive of House Bill 3582, which would extend the BETC sunset through 2021. Cities see the Business Energy Tax Credit, or BETC, as a critical component of incentivizing energy efficiency, spurring development of renewable energy technology, and fostering an economic climate that's conducive for the growth of the rapidly expanding field of clean energy. Over the past 5 years, 56 cities have taken advantage of the BETC program. These are cities, urban and rural, and actually cities that lie in every district with the members of this committee. In that span of time, cities have received a little over $15 million in tax credits. This represents only 2% of the tax credit dollars awarded in that time period. But we think the benefits to taxpayers and to our constituents redound because the benefits of the program reduce costs in electricity, heating, and transportation, allow our members to expand services, critical services to our members. The cities of Portland and Corvallis are here to talk specifically about how they use the BETC. I just want to highlight a couple of the ways in which our members are utilizing this important tax credit program. Cottage Grove has invested in energy efficiency upgrades at its wastewater treatment plant, saving the city nearly $25,000 on energy costs annually. The cities of Canyonville, Dallas, Drain, Waldport, and Winston have also made significant energy efficiency upgrades, saving about $25,000 in the process. Gresham has used the BETC to install solar panels and a cogeneration unit at its wastewater treatment facility, saving nearly $300,000 in energy costs annually. And the city of Pendleton installed Solar World-built solar panels at its wastewater treatment plant facility and produces more than 250,000 kilowatt hours. Some of the investments that our cities make are large, some are small, but again, each is critical to providing, to properly using and most efficiently using the taxpayer dollars that we collect. We think this is an important program, and we encourage you to extend its sunset date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Jim Mitchell. I'm the Transportation and Buildings Division Manager for the City of Corvallis, Oregon. I'm here to talk about how Corvallis uses the Betsy. We use it both for energy conservation projects and things like our library and swimming pool, fire stations with solar hot water heaters, those kinds of things. And you've heard a lot already about how energy efficiency programs are really a good bang for the buck. So I really want to talk a little bit more about how we use it for transit, because we use it differently than what you just heard from the previous panel. We're a municipally run transit operation. We're not a district, so we do not get state funding from in lieu of, for example. We are using Betsy to help with transit operations and to help us with the local match on bus purchases. Our system provides, we're on target to provide about 800,000 rides this year. In the testimony I've provided to you in written, we've given you a breakdown as to percentages for seniors, persons with disabilities, youth, that sort of thing, which shows the community effort or the impact of our transit system. It results in about a $600,000 value to Corvallis that we use for local match for federal. So it's about a $1.2 million impact to our operation, which is about a $2.5 million operation. So without Betsy, we're losing about $1.2 million. We'd be cutting our service in about half. Of the small urban areas in Corvallis, in Oregon, we're the only one that currently meets the small transit intensive city criteria of the FTA, so we're eligible for more federal funding. So if we can maintain our service, we can provide that level of service for all of our community members. And we're really focused to be totally inclusive for all of our members. And in the testimony, you can see some of the stuff you've already heard. So I'm not going to repeat that for you. So thank you for your time. I hope you support this bill.
Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3582 and extension of the current Betsy sunset dates. The Betsy is a critically important economic development tool, both in the City of Portland and we believe for the state, in terms of recruiting businesses and developing an innovative business cluster. Just 2 weeks ago, there was an announcement of a new solar power, solar manufacturing plant in North Portland that will create nearly 500 jobs. The Betsy manufacturing credit is a key component of the financing deal for that plant. The Betsy also supports a business environment more generally that supports firms with a strong Portland presence, such as Vestas and Revolt. City Betsy projects leverage the Betsy against local and federal funds to deliver tremendous community benefits. Amongst the projects that the city is pursuing currently include installation of a micro hydro turbine to generate 15 kilowatts of power at the Vernon Water Tower. It's taking advantage of a unique opportunity to generate power. The city has transportation projects that in 2010 reduced vehicle miles traveled by 65 million miles, conserved 3.2 million gallons of gasoline, and saved Oregonians over $11 million in transportation-related costs, delivering a return on investment for the Betsy of 7-to-1. These projects also reduce congestion, which promotes the mobility of freight and commerce and reduces the need for very expensive capital projects for transportation. One of the projects the city is involved with is filling a financing gap using the Betsy for a streetcar vehicle and spare parts as part of the East Side Loop for the city's streetcar network. The streetcar is being purchased from Oregon-based United Streetcar, which has quite a few Oregon suppliers as well. This project is pre-certified under the Betsy Conservation Program for purchase of the product, but has benefits that are very much like the Betsy manufacturing credit. And that's just an example of how the Betsy across the board can have very important benefits for Oregon-based businesses. I think we see similar effects with some of the solar manufacturing in the state. Certainly the project that Portland Public Schools discussed related to transit passes for high school students in Portland is very important for the city. It's not only a way to get students to school, it's ultimately a workforce development tool, and that it gets them to their jobs, it gets them to the right school. We have magnet schools in Portland. It also gets students to community colleges to take courses as well. Moving forward, we would strongly support that you build upon the reforms that you adopted in 2010. We would urge you to provide as much of a bridge as possible in terms of funding for these BETC projects. We appreciate that you're facing tremendous budgetary problems or challenges, but certainly these projects are very important for communities around the state and for the state's economic development. We'd also encourage you to give special consideration for projects that have already obtained pre-certification. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Daniel, I appreciate the economic data that you've provided us. Those 500 people in Portland are pretty important. Any idea how much BETC credit was utilized by that company or will be utilized by that company?
I believe that was a $20 million manufacturing BETC. I would gladly verify that and get back to you to confirm that number.
A follow-up. And so 500 people, I don't know, $50,000 a year, 10% into the general fund is $2.5 million probably for a $20 million BETC. Can you expand upon maybe some of the peripheral job creation that would be in addition to the $2.5 million coming back into the general fund?
Co-Chair Bailey, Senator Telfer, I'd be happy to forward information to the committee regarding the economic development benefits of that project, but I can't speak to specific numbers.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just simply note that a $20 million BETC manufacturing results in a $10 million credit.
Thank you. Go ahead and call up Craig Strobeck, Sean Sosnovic, and Doris Pendle. If they are here. Not seeing Mr. Sosnovic, so I will go ahead and call up Margie Hoffman. Please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Brady, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Craig Strobeck. Advanced Energy Systems is our company. We are a commercial solar installer contractor in Eugene. Our footprint is statewide. Our projects range from Portland to Medford to Salem to Eugene, and we utilize the BETC. What I did today in the handout you're going to get is I tried to give you a snapshot of what our actual usage of the BETC in construction and creation has been in a sample of eight recent projects. So you'll have that, and I don't want to read it and take your time up, but it of a $1.5 roughly million-dollar BETC credits that were given, nearly $1.3 million was spent right back in Oregon to Oregon suppliers, Solar World, EV Powered, the manufacturers. An additional $800,000 was spent right back into direct job wages, benefits, payroll taxes, health insurance, et cetera. And then we have subcontractors that utilize the projects that we spent money on. Since our reach is statewide, we stay in motels. We stay at people eat out and so forth. There's per diem wages, per diem jobs, or per diem funds, excuse me. And then there's economic value to the permits and fees. What we're seeing is 90% or more of the money that comes into the project, not only the BETC, but the total dollars coming into the project, is recycled right back into Oregon. That's our goal, that's our mantra, and that's what our proposals state. So when we get a project, it goes back to the people in Hillsboro making the solar plant. It goes to the people in Bend. It goes to the Lane Transit District in Eugene in payroll taxes. So that money is being utilized locally. We support nearly 30 jobs. We estimate we created or supported in a peripheral 75 additional jobs. We can't quantify, obviously, how far down the chain goes. And then the environmental impact, the economic savings for the energy that would be created is over $2 million over the lifetime of the systems at a fixed rate of power. One of the things that we're also doing is trying to maximize the cost of the Betsy. The Betsy was maximized the efficiency, I want to say. As the Betsy's been utilized, we've seen the efficiency of our installations get greater. We were able to put more for less, and we're continuing to strive for that. A system we can put on today will generate more power than it did last year. And I think the Tanner Creek gentleman, I agree with him, testified last week that prices and costs of installations are down 50% for what they were some years ago. We're seeing that, and we're seeing moving forward. So what we support is continuing the program. Obviously, funding is going to be an issue, but dismantling the program means that things that are in the pipeline and advances that are made, we feel we're just going to, it's going to come to a screeching halt. And the people that we've taken out of colleges and trained and electricians and renewable jobs will have no place to go. That's our concern. Thank you.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Renewable Northwest Project. In the essence of time, I'm going to swap out with Renewable Northwest Project's Deputy Director, John Audley. But I brought with me today three handouts for the committee. At the beginning of session, this committee sent out a series of questions asking people to justify their tax credit program. So we have took that seriously. We have a 23-page document outlining the answers, detailed answers with graphs and charts and all kinds of stuff as answers to those questions. I also have a document that breaks down the property tax revenue that's been generated by the wind industry to the state of Oregon with graphs on the back of that document outlining the counties that receive those benefits. And the third thing is on behalf of the Clean Energy Finance Coalition, we have generated case studies of all different kinds of companies and organizations throughout the state who utilize this program. And in addition, in order to save time, they wanted to turn in their case studies as opposed to coming down and saying they're 2 minutes each. So Doris will go. I'll swap out. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. And I would note for the committee that the document that's being passed out has each of the questions that the committee posed to the policy committees with charts and graphs in detail on it. So we thank you for putting this together. It's extremely helpful. Ms. Penwell.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Counties and Community Renewables. And I'm here today to emphasize how important the Betsy has been to the whole clean energy industry in Oregon, to the communities that these projects are in. And we can say definitely that we haven't finished our job, whether it be in energy conservation, generation, or manufacturing. With passage of the 2007 RPS and the companion upscale of the tax credit, we know for a fact that we put in place a system that brought in businesses and individuals that were willing to invest in Oregon, both manufacturing as well as generation and conservation. And in the current economic climate, with a lot of projects moving ahead, it is very important that we continue a system that allows at least the small to medium-sized projects to come to fruition, to create the jobs, to make the investment, to invest in the community, and to keep things going in Oregon. Community after community across the state has really benefited from this sort of investment. And we just hope you, and I'm sure you understand it, we all understand what the situation of the budget is and the economy, but this is part of getting us out of that hole. And so we really encourage that you use this bill or others to move toward a transition of some kind that allows us to keep these projects and this system going so that once we get back on our feet, we can continue to improve the clean energy industry in Oregon. one of the, there are a couple more comments I'd like to make. First of all, manufacturing tends to benefit urban areas. Conservation tends to benefit small and large communities where most of the people gather. Generation tends to benefit the rural areas of Oregon. And all of that together serves the whole state. So I want to close by saying that in generation alone, we've created about $5.4 billion in investment in generation alone. And that in the counties that have developed those projects, they've reached up to $55 million in property taxes to date, much more to come over the coming years. So it's important to these counties and others where projects are just now getting developed that we continue this momentum. It's helping us to pay for some of these services that other people are talking about. In the counties where they've developed now, they're able to do some of this work, and before they could not. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Oddly.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for letting me sit in for Margie. My name is John Oddly. I'm Deputy Director of Renewable Northwest Project. My apologies not for not being with you earlier this week, but along with most of the members of Oregon's wind renewable energy community, I attended the annual meeting of the American Wind Energy Association. In a sea of thousands of vendors, Oregon-based companies like Iberdrola Renewables, Vestas Americas, Anexco, Renewable Energy Systems, Horizon Wind Energy, EverPower, Stoll Reeve, CH2M Hill stood out proudly representing Oregon and its investments in renewable energy. Our allies, the Portland Development Commission and the Columbia Gorge Bi-State Renewable Energy Zone, plus a handful of allies on the other side of the river, were there as well, advertising Oregon as a place to come and do business because we feel so strongly about renewable energy. Under any other circumstances, in a down economy period, an industry capable of achieving $5.5 billion of investments in rural communities, $55 million in taxes paid so far, and a generation commitment to pay those taxes forward, thousands of jobs created, and leading the nation in movement towards a 21st century economy, we'd celebrate the addition of one more sector dedicated to the responsible harvesting of Oregon's rich natural resources to the benefit of our state, the region, the nation, and the world. Rather than fending off attacks from critics, we'd be celebrating one bright spot in Oregon's economy. But such is not the case, and instead we're here to discuss how to complete the dismantling of one of the most successful policies in recent Oregon history, the Oregon Business Energy Tax Credit. Working with many members of this committee, last year we rolled up our sleeves, reduced the state's exposure to the Business Energy Tax Credit by correcting some of its weaknesses. RNP supported that outcome because at that time we knew it was the right thing to do for the state. Because we remain in an economic slump, once again we find ourselves acknowledging the need for fiscal restraint on renewable energy incentives. But while we all recognize the importance of good fiscal discipline, I urge you not to forego developing policy incentives that will help return Oregon to that list of national leaders in renewable energy investment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Burdick.
I'm a little unclear. Are you, when we passed the legislation last session, we drastically scaled down wind. Are you arguing for continuing subsidies for wind?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes, we did reduce incentives for industrial-scale wind energy, and yes, I am in support of continued support for industrial-scale wind energy.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Given the issues that we now have with transmission, with Bonneville having to basically choose between hydro and wind power transmission, do you think this is a wise investment to be subsidizing wind power that may not even be able to get on the grid?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, the issues related to the Bonneville Power Administration's policies on overgeneration are issues that we are working very hard to resolve. They are not all issues, as Bonneville has described them. Just a few days ago, my boss, Rachel Shimshack, was here talking to you all about it. I'm happy to provide you with what we believe to be better alternatives to resolving this issue. We need to build more transmission. We need to determine how to pay those costs so that they are broadly distributed. But let's face it, if we are going to turn down 1,500 megawatts of power, that's the Boardman facility in Oregon and two coal facilities in Washington, we need more renewable energy, ma'am.
Final follow-up question. Do you ever see a point at which we will not need to subsidize wind and some of these other renewables? Is this a permanent situation that you envision?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, if the president is successful getting the oil incentives for oil and gas out of our system, perhaps we'll have a level playing field for all forms of energy.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. If, in fact, there was no credit, the ratepayer would be paying for this. What do you think would happen to wind generation possibilities if, in fact, the ratepayer was paying for it?
Co-chairs, Senator Telfer, I understand, I believe I understand the direction you're saying, and that's that because a state or any government body subsidizes one particular energy source, customers benefit in that sense, or and if they don't, the rates are going to be higher. The Bonneville system we enjoy, that is the lifeblood of our economy, was the product of federal tax dollars. And because of that, we have some of the lowest power in the country, which is fantastic, that we have chosen as a nation to incentivize a new form of energy and try and put it on par with fossil fuel doesn't seem to be a stretch for me. In both instances, customers benefit because we are dispersing the costs of that energy across the public as opposed to the individual.
Follow-up? Just the answer I'm looking for. What would happen if there was no credit and it wasn't subsidized and the ratepayer was faced with looking at increasing their rates and what they pay for energy? Where do you think we would be with wind?
Co-Chair Senator Telfer, the last time I read a Portland General Electric's integrated resource plan, and that was when natural gas prices were a little higher than they are now, it argued that buying wind energy was cost competitive with all other forms of new energy. So I would say that to argue that they are more expensive than other forms of energy is simply not true any longer.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'd like to make one final question, Mr. Chair. I'm Doris Kenwell again. A lot of this discussion is about the utility scale development of any of these resources. There are many, many projects around Oregon that are not at the utility scale that are wonderful for communities, and I want you to keep that in mind. All technologies are in that field, and they're really wonderful investments in the community. So it's not just about the large-scale projects. Thanks a lot.
I second that statement, by the way.
Great. Thank you to this panel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I don't have a name here, or if I do, it's missing. I have Horizon Project Development written down, as well as Sandra Walden and Dan Bates. And Marion Haynes, Gary Bauer, and Tom O'Connor are on deck. Please go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, Chair and Co-Chair. Thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Clark Munkle. I live in Astoria, Oregon. I've been an Oregonian for 37 years. I'm a principal with Horizon Project Development, a small business formed to develop a utility-scale solar generation project of up to 100 megawatts in Jefferson County. The location of our project is near Ashwood, Oregon, on over 1,000 acres of low-value agricultural land. I have two partners, one whose family has owned the land since it was homesteaded over 100 years ago. The other runs a business that's been in his family for over 90 years. Our company and its partners have made significant investments in this project over the last 2 years, including hiring local professional service firms to confirm project feasibility and conduct financial analysis, and to conduct discussions with transmission providers and utility off-takers. We have partnered with Jefferson County on developing the solar generation potential of similar low-value farmland. And this project has included a wide variety of stakeholders from other landowners to the State Department of Land Conservation and Development to 1,000 Friends of Oregon. In sum, our company, its partners, our project, and our approach is truly a homegrown Oregon-based initiative designed to bring over 150 to 200 construction jobs and up to 30 full-time jobs to an economically distressed community. I'm here to urge the committee and the Oregon legislation to pass House Bill 3582. The tax incentives extended by the House bill are essential to bringing jobs, revenue, and hope to rural Oregon. This bill is also necessary to level the playing field so that Oregonians with long-standing ties to the state and the local community can participate in a market that, without these incentives, is only open to the largest utilities and the wealthiest corporations. The programs saved by House Bill 3582 are not tax breaks for the wealthy. They are for people like me, ranchers like my partner, who have made the decision to put their land to the highest and best use. And companies like ours with a direct stake in the local community and a track record of working with all Oregonian stakeholders in this process. I appreciate your consideration and time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning. Co-chairs and committee. I'm Sandra Walden. I am the owner of Rural Energy Solutions, previously Commercial Solar Ventures. We're a small development company and consulting company now, working in Oregon for over 5 years. We've developed a financial model that allowed for the Portland Development, or I'm sorry, the Portland Habilitation Center, the City of Portland's Water Bureau, the City of Portland's Park Bureau, among others, to install and eventually will own solar facilities using this investor model that takes advantage of the federal tax credits, the BETSI, the Energy Trust of Oregon funds. For nonprofits and government entities, this convoluted legal tax structures are the only way that solar can be installed and take advantage of the federal tax money, which is 30% of the value of a project. With the cap imposed in the last legislative session and the uncertainty that surrounded allocations of the BETSI, as well as the reevaluation of pre-certed projects, most all project investment capital sources abandoned Oregon to places with more legislative certainty. The seven large commercial projects that Real Energy Solutions had booked represented over 6 megawatts, which is no longer viable in Oregon. Most of my past employees are now working in other states. I encourage you to think carefully about the severe reduction of the BETSI and the RETSI programs for several reasons. For jobs, as chair of the Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association, it's obvious that jobs will be lost. These jobs losses will reverse a trend of job growth in the solar industry for the past several years and bring to a sudden halt expansions that have been planned and that currently exist. Education is vital and worthy of public support, such as OIT's renewable energy program, the first 4-year renewable energy degree in the nation. Unfortunately, graduates of this program won't be able to find jobs in Oregon. We will have educated them to work in another state. Or they'll be forced to sit idle while their education becomes dated. Solar projects provide living wage jobs, and the BETSI is still needed to support these and other renewables in order to grow Oregon's green economy. That said, regardless of the funding level, I urge the committee to ensure good policy is in place for when times are better. Keep the program and make it better. Since its inception, the BETSI has been repurposed and this has created a tremendous amount of confusion for everyone involved. Is the state's goal to fund projects that would not otherwise be economically viable, or to get the most power generation for the least dollars spent, or to help boost the economy with living wage jobs, or to develop a variety of clean tech industries in the state, or some combination of these? Does climate change influence the decision, or energy security? If so, how? All technologies are not created equal. In order to have a variety of energy resource generation to meet the RPS and support the clusters that already exist, we need certainty of funding, clear criteria for qualification, guaranteed funds based on meeting those criteria, and consistent rules for administering the funds over time. Finally, a clear path and exit ramp should exist for technologies that no longer require state support. The federal government is committed to supporting solar at least until 2016. Every year Oregon does not lend support to solar is a lost year of leveraging these scarce federal dollars that represent 30% of eligible cost. And lastly, we cannot meet our energy needs through conservation alone. Solar is the sister to energy conservation, from distributed generation on residential and commercial rooftops to utility-scale systems that reduce our dependency on foreign oil generation. Buildings that pair solar with conservation are capable of achieving net zero energy use. This is a worthy goal. We have the ability to install enough solar to defer upgrades and or new distribution and generation facilities. The longer these major capital expenditures are deferred by utilities, the longer we keep prices low for all ratepayers. In summary, there's no question that deep cuts need to be made in tax credits this season, along with cuts for other worthy programs. Given this reality, the question then is, how do we restructure and improve the mechanisms that already are in place in a very successful program and take advantage of future funding sources so that Oregon can continue to grow its clean tech economy and maintain its reputation as a forward-thinking leader in renewable energy? Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question before we move on? You said that employees and people had moved to other states that had better subsidies.
Yes.
I looked into this in great depth last session. I found no state that even came close to Oregon's subsidies. So I would like to find out from you what those states are and what you know about the subsidies.
New Jersey, California, recently New Mexico. And to consider time here, we will provide through OSEA that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bates.
Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be before you today. Dan Bates, today representing Revolt Technologies. Revolt Technology is the next generation battery developer. Zinc Air is their technology. There is great hope that that will provide longer lasting and more cost-effective batteries in all kinds of applications. I'm here today to tell you a success story involved with the Betsy, which is Oregon was able to attract Revolt Technology to move its international headquarters from Zurich to Oregon. Part of that was a roughly $1.3 million conservation research and development Betsy, part of other programs, including leveraging illustrious $5 million ARPA-E federal grant, which is awarded to the top technology companies in the United States. As a result, Revolt is planning to hire 160 new people by 2015. They're already starting to hire folks, attracting world-class scientists to Oregon, hiring Oregonians for other positions, in addition to building out a facility in Portland. The perspective from Revolt I would offer is two with regard to why programs like the Conservation Betsy are important. First is as they look into new lines of research and development, as they think through where to do other lines of manufacturing, Oregon remains and needs to remain competitive in that. They're committed to having the international headquarters here, but there are a lot of other places that are competing for various elements of new research, and that's not just New York or Ohio or Texas, as they were looking last time, but Dortmund, Germany, various places in China. We are, in fact, in a world-class battle for this new technology. The second is what is very important as they look for the future on Oregon is the other companies that are attracted as a result of what we've been able to do from a cluster perspective. And so they are very interested in other technology companies being able to be here, the incentives that Oregon is able to offer to attract them, to attract new federal dollars, and helping find that synergies and growing their cluster in battery technology, but other applications, whether in renewables or electric vehicles. And in so the broad range of incentives across the board that the state offers in that helps create an ecosystem in Oregon that is attractive to folks, and we are indeed competing with the rest of the world on that. And with that, I would also urge, I know that you have many tough choices, and these are difficult times, and hope with some good news with Revolt, but also urge you, in spite of the budget challenges you face, to continue to keep this program alive, to send the message that Oregon remains open for business despite these difficulties, even if you have to make some adjustments. These programs helped attract Revolt. They will help attract others and are, and will help propel Oregon further in this new technology arena. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bates, could you comment briefly as you talk about that larger cluster around batteries and electric vehicles, where some of the critical investments are and where this program might be targeted in terms of building out, say, the infrastructure that's necessary to support the broader application in this cluster?
Absolutely. And if we're, Chair Bailey, thank you for the question. If we're speaking specifically, for example, an electric vehicle range, which is where the zinc air battery has its second application, the first is actually hearing aids, but the second would be electric vehicles. They're very interested both on the incentive side for manufacturing as well as in research and development along different ranges. So the Betsy in these different areas attracting other capital into the region from other components in the electric vehicle space to the vehicles themselves. But also on the consumer side credits, which Betsy helps provide on the business side, from infrastructure, making this a place where people want to drive electric vehicles helps propel the market and helps attract people to be here so they can place their products in these initial launch markets. And in particular, focusing on electric vehicle infrastructure as well as trying to consumer credits for businesses and fleets trying to drive up the number of vehicles in Oregon, I think are worthy investments in addition to the mainstream Betsy programs.
Thank you. Coach Berger.
I still don't have a definition of electric vehicle infrastructure. What does that mean in terms of somebody who's never driven? And I mean, I know what a car is.
Absolutely. Chair Bailey, Chair Berger, electric vehicle infrastructure, great. I suppose it's code. It's essentially the fueling station for alternative fuel vehicles.
Okay, we're talking about non-gas stations.
That's right.
Thank you. It's needed a definition. That I understand.
Thank you very much. Go ahead and call up Marion Haynes, Gary Bauer, and Tom O'Connor. Peter Greenberg, Ross, I'm going to butcher this, Swartzen Derber, I think, and Jody Weiser are on deck.
Good morning, Chair Bailey, committee members. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. PGE serves more than 820,000 customers in 52 cities, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. PGE understands the budget situation that the state is facing and the implications that that has for the tax credits that have been sunset. That being said, we do support preserving and extending the Betsy program, even if the funding is substantially reduced, because it provides value for our customers and for the state, both from an economic and environmental perspective. Over the next decade, PG expects to meet nearly half of the growth in electricity demand through energy efficiency. The Betsy is usually a component of most energy efficiency projects receiving energy trust funding. It's often needed to reduce the final payback to an acceptable level and get more projects funded than would happen without it. In working with our customers to implement energy efficiency projects, having the Betsy often determines whether those projects will move forward. The energy trust incentive alone is usually not enough to make a customer take action. The Betsy, therefore, helps create jobs throughout the Oregon economy, and not only for those who supply equipment and conduct retrofits. It also provides businesses with more money in their pockets, money that can be reinvested in the economy. Similarly, the Betsy has played an important role in renewable energy generation. PGE's large-scale utility wind projects, such as Bigelow, no longer qualify for the Betsy credit. We understand that. We did not use it for the last phase of that project. However, we do believe that Betsy still plays a role in facilitating other technologies and smaller projects. These projects also have positive job impacts, not only for installers, but also Oregon manufacturers. For example, projects that we have done with ODOT include solar panels and inverters from Oregon companies. Having a diverse portfolio of generation resources is good for PGE and our customers. Again, we understand the substantial funding reductions that are necessary given the state's budget environment, but do support continuing the Betsy program, and we're also taking this opportunity to look at potential changes that we may suggest to you to make sure that the dollars are used most efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, and I'll try to be quick because I know you've listened to many hours of this. Northwest Natural is not a large user of the Betsy, and generally when we do use Betsy, it's often in conjunction with one of our customers, and sometimes we're the pass-through partner that they use. We've used the Betsy with municipalities, with educational institutions, and with some R&D projects, for example, biodigesters with some dairies to try to determine whether or not we can take their waste, reduce it, capture the gas, and actually try to get some energy out of that. We think it's an important program. We think it's very important both from a conservation standpoint as well as to the economy. Many of these projects that we work on do have some fairly highly skilled workers involved in them, electricians, plumbers. There's a lot of engineering that goes into this. So we do think there's a value to the state and to the economy. But we recognize that you do have a major task in front of you deciding what to do. We'd like to be part of that process, part of that discussion, and we will continue to try to find ways of reducing that. We agree that you should not spend dollars when the projects are cost effective already. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, members of the co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Tom O'Connor. I'm director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We represent 11 of the small and smaller municipal utilities serving in Oregon, I'm here to just to support extension of the business energy tax credit. We've since 1978, between utilities, energy codes, federal efficiency standards, and the tax credits, the region has saved almost 4,000 average megawatts. In our new contracts that were our new Bonneville contracts for the next 10 years, we're being called upon to double the amount of energy savings that we've achieved over the last 10 years. We've achieved those goals always in the past. This is going to be a tough goal, but we think we can do it. We recognize that the horrible budget situation we're in, we do recognize that these tax credits need to be reduced. We think that's appropriate given the times.
we've had to do that with our energy efficiency programs in the past, ramp them down at certain times and ramp them back up as times as conditions improved. The discussions that we've had with our energy efficiency folks at this stage, we would suggest as you're cutting the programs, it'd probably be better to kind of across the board, if you will, to maintain a basic level in these programs that then we can ramp up if the economy improves, rather than trying to pick winners and losers at this stage of the game. The other question that I know the committee asked was the sort of but-for question. I can't give you any statistics, hard statistics, but in talking with our conservation folks, they always say that in making the decisions about whether to go forward with an energy efficiency or a small-scale renewable project, the customer is really looking at all the programs that are available. The tax credits are a very important part of that. Our incentives are an important part of that. The signal from the state that these programs, that energy efficiency and small renewables are important, is also critical to that decision. So recognize that the cuts need to be made. We're here to agree with that, but hope you can maintain a level that will preserve the program at some minimum level that we can fill back in later. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much, colleagues. We're going to have a slight change of plans. We have one more panel, but we have a quorum here. And while we do have that quorum and we're getting late in the hour, I'm going to go ahead and recess this public hearing temporarily. We'll reopen it and open a work session on House Bill 2527. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2527 extends the sunset date for the Oregon Affordable Housing Lenders Credit from January 1, 2014 to January 1, 2020. The bill is just a simple extension of that sunset. In your packet, you have a revenue impact that shows zero impact for the 11-13 biennium, and then a revenue loss of about $2.5 to $3 million in 13-15 and about $5 million in 15-17. And you also have a fiscal impact statement that reflects a minimal expenditure impact.
Great. Colleagues, what's your pleasure? Co-Chair Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2554A to...
Excuse me, 2527.
2527 to report out due pass. This is a new one. To report out due pass. It's my recollection that we had extensive testimony on this, that moving this sunset is important to keep the investment in these projects going. The uncertainty around it sort of is a dampener on the investors who go forward with these kinds of projects, which really help our housing issues. So report out, do pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Berger moves House Bill 2527 to report out due pass. Is there discussion? I think I saw Senator Haas first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support this extension, but now that we're getting down to it, I think before we go much further, we need to know exactly how much we can spend. I know this isn't this biennium, but I think that would be helpful in future biennium as well. Because without those numbers, all of these are great ideas, but at some point there needs to be, all of these are, you know, I think meritorious and need to be changed or whatever, but it's hard for us to know exactly what the hard choices are if we're going to be the reverse Ways and Means Committee until we know what the levels are that we're supposed to be staying under.
Senator Haas, may I clarify your remark that you're speaking to subsequent after next biennium in the future?
Yes.
Senator Tuffle.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I've got to say that the good senator said exactly what I was going to say, and that, you know, it's kind of how do we start approving these things when we don't know how much money we have to spend? But I understand this one has a time problem with it as far as projects. But I would hope that we hold back approving extensions of any credits until we see them all, hear about all of them, and know what money we have to spend.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if it would be in order to make a motion to table so that we could bring this up at a later time when the answer to the question has arrived.
We are under a current motion.
Right. The motion, I'm proposing to move to table the current motion, which would, of course, would allow the committee to resurrect it at any time by a motion to withdraw from the table. But it would also allow for us to take the time to answer Senator Hass's question.
Why don't we have the committee stand at ease for a moment?
Yeah.
Welcome back from our brief pause. We are back on work session on 2527 and additional discussion. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I am prepared to move forward on this one bill, and the reason being the lag time and the development. We have a time crunch here. We have no fiscal impact in the next biennium or no revenue impact in the next biennium. That gives us a lot of time to deal with the $2.5 million. But I will say that I don't know that we can move any of the other credits forward in the very near future until we know what we have to spend. So, but this one being a little different, we actually have 4 years to deal with the $2.5 million.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think similar to Senator Telfer, it is not an issue with this credit, but I think the expenditure issue is one that is not just for this biennium. We have to understand where it is that we're going in out bienniums. And choosing any of these credits that we renew eats away from what will be available for us to spend in future tax credits. So I am willing to vote for this one today. I wish that we could take another couple of days to consider this more carefully, but I will be very reluctant to support any other tax credits moving forward without the understanding of that cost in the out biennia. I think that those pieces are just as important as well as this current spending. We need to be planful moving into the future.
Thank you.
Chair.
Commissioner Burton.
I just want the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee has acquired, I think, a well-deserved Grinch-like reputation from the last session on our evaluation of tax credits.
Grinch-like.
And the folks who came to talk to us on this particular credit made a very powerful case. It was one of only two credits that made it through the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee in the last session. And as the Grinch in chief, I feel very comfortable moving this forward.
Well, with that ringing endorsement, colleagues, I would add to it that I agree with all of the statements that have been made. And, colleagues, I think we will be examining this very closely, and that in the next biennium, as we take a look at what the subsequent biennium's challenges are going to be, this will continue to be in play even in next biennium. And that we will need to do a real continuous evaluation of this program. But because of the cycle and because of the lag time and because this is a bit of a horse of a different color, we need to move forward on it now, keeping in mind that it is not being removed from further scrutiny. Okay. And with that, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
Excused.
Representative
Dent.
Aye.
Senator Telfer.
Aye.
Senator
Peck.
Aye.
Representative Warren.
Aye.
Representative Belcher.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Senator
Burdick. Aye. Motion passes. And we'll need two carriers, volunteers. Representative Barnhart.
I'm happy to carry.
Senator Telfer. We have one more work session. Very brief. Okay. Great. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2527 and open a work session on House Bill 2154A. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2154. You heard back in April, and it makes some definitional modifications to the farm worker housing construction credit. It does not change the sunset of the current program. You do have two amendments in your packet, a dash 4 and a dash 5. The dash 4 is in response to concerns in the drafted bill that granted rulemaking authority to the department. The concern was that the rulemaking authority with respect to the definition of a farm worker was too broad. What the dash 4 does is remove that language, so they would no longer have that rulemaking authority, so they would have to come back to the legislature to seek a definitional change. And the dash A5 removes a number of changes to the transferability of the credit. This is one of the 8 or so credits that is transferable in law, and this made a number of changes to that transferability. And in talking with the department, it didn't really work with the structure of how that credit operates. So all of that language pertaining to the transferability is removed. So adoption of the dash 5 would leave unchanged the transferability of the credit. The way it is currently transferable would be the same through adoption of the dash A5. You do have minimal revenue impact for the remainder of the time that this credit is on the books, and then you have a minimal fiscal impact for both the dash 4 and dash 5.
So to be clear, this bill is a technical change in the definition around farm worker housing, the mechanics of it. It is not an extension of the credit. That is a subsequent bill that we will consider at a later point in this committee process.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair, Chris, remind me again on the transferability issue. what was in the bill on transferability was unworkable, and so the A5s changed it back to what was workable? Is that?
That would be a correct characterization.
Okay. Thank you.
Clegg, it's your pleasure.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2154.
A. Co-Chair Burdick moves the Dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2154. Discussion. Objections. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Burdick.
I would move the Dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2154.
Co-Chair Burdick moves the Dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2154. Discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm about two-thirds of the way through parsing this. Could we take just a moment? I hadn't seen this amendment until just now.
Chris, you want to offer additional explanation? Is there questions for staff?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm about two-thirds of the way through parsing it. I suspect I'll vote yes on it, but I don't know until I've finished, if I may. Thank you.
Chris has a hand engrossed version as well, if you are interested.
As I understand, Chris, this just gets us back to the status quo on the transferability issue. They tried to make a change and decided that wouldn't work, and so A5 establishes,
yes.
It reestablishes the status quo.
I could put out, it deletes a lot of bold language or reinserts italicized language. One issue that did come up in producing the fiscal impact yesterday on Section 5 of the bill on page 7, the Dash A5 removes that Section 5, which is ORS 315053, which limits the transferability of a handful of number of certain credits to a C corporation, S corporation, but...
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've finished, and I'm prepared to vote on the motion.
Further discussion? Motion. Objection. So ordered. Mr. Burdick.
Gosh, I would have paid better attention. I move House Bill 2154 out of this committee with a due pass recommendation. Is that good enough, Paul?
Co-Chair Berger moves House Bill 2150. Oh, excuse me, Co-Chair Burdick. There's so many B's around.
All of us.
Co-Chair Burdick moves House Bill 2154 as amended with a due pass recommendation out of this committee. Further discussion. Seeing none, is there objection? It is so ordered. Carriers.
Okay. Oh, you can take it.
I'd be happy to carry
your
it. Yeah. Senate? Sarah Morse. Okay. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2154. We will not be doing a work session on House Bill 2196A. And colleagues, we are about out of time. I'd like to still bring up the last panel. If you can stick around for a little bit, that's great. If not, understand that everybody has commitments. So I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3582 and call up Peter Greenberg, Jody Weiser, Russ Swartzen, Druber. Please go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairs Bailey, Burdick, and Berger, and committee members for hanging around a little bit longer. My name is Ross Swartzen-Druber. I'm the president of Salem Creative Network. We are a 501c3 organized to provide creative solutions for social innovation here in Salem. I'd like to talk to you today about the Solarize Salem program that was instituted between August and October of 2010. We offered bulk pricing for solar panels here in Salem. We had 52 homeowners sign up for this. Most of those participated in the RETC and also in the feed-in tariff. And I guess that's what I kind of like to talk about a little bit today.
And Mr. say your name one more time again.
Schwarzendruber.
Schwarzendruber.
Yes.
Schwarzendruber. We do have a copy of your PowerPoint.
Thank you.
Here in front of us. We'll be sure to peruse that in depth. So
great. Now, I'm just going to touch on a few things. Basically, we have started a commercial program also for bulk solar purchasing and have run into some barriers with getting into the Betsy program and also getting into the feed-in tariff program. And our organization likes to provide creative solutions. We would like to see the extension of the Betsy and also transition that funding or the funding mechanism for renewables into a feed-in tariff. And what that would do is put us on par to switch it from taxpayer-funded to ratepayer-funded, and that would, you know, ease those subsidies. But in order for that to happen, there needs to be a baseline established for pricing on the feed-in tariff, which means that that Betsy needs to be extended to find out where that baseline pricing is. And the Betsy, the feed-in tariff program is going for another 2 years. If there could be some way we could work into the legislation that that program is accelerated and the programs for the Betsy are transferred over to this feed-in tariff, that's what we'd recommend. And there's a lot of data here of where Germany is, which is where the best model for a feed-in tariff, and also where the U.S. is for solar marketing, and that information is provided by EUPD Research. It's about a week old, so you have the best information possible for forecasting for the solar market internationally and in the States. It would be great if this could be the bottle bill of, you know, our generation. I was picking up pop cans in the 60s. And this has the opportunity for my grandkids to breathe fresh air and have a clean environment. So if we could transition this over to renewables in a feed-in tariff, that's what our organization would like to recommend. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Not seeing Mr. Greenberg or Ms. Weiser, we thank you. Oh.
Sorry.
Come forward.
Glad most of you know me. We make lighting fixtures in Eugene.
And I'm sorry, for the record.
Peter Greenberg, EnergyWise Lighting. We manufacture lighting fixtures. We're a few weeks away from coming out with a solar water heater that we got a Betsy manufacturer's tax credit on and federal money. We've got most of the feed-in tariff the last go-around, or 40% of it in PGE, so we kind of know all ends of the spectrum. I helped form the Betsy program 30 years ago. Basically, energy efficiency is a lot cheaper than renewable energy. It would be great to think that solar is going to be cheap, but I don't think it'll ever be that cheap. We did a job in Albany saving 800,000 kilowatt hours for a manufacturer for 140,000. To put solar on that would be about $3 or $4 million. You can give away energy efficiency, pay 100% of the cost, and it would still be a 30th of what you're giving for renewables. I just don't quite understand. The legislature keeps saying, well, how many jobs you're producing, and asking a lot of questions, but there's nothing in the Betsy bill pertaining to any of this. I think you really need to give the Department of Energy some focus, saying what you want out of the program, how to design the program correctly. If it's not doing what you want, make it do the right thing. I mean, it makes sense to save energy and not send money out of state, not burn coal in Utah. But the program now is so disjointed. It's I can't even make a program smaller, or a project smaller if I want, without taking 4 months of paperwork from Betsy. You can replace it with low-interest loans. PERS can invest instead of stocks in other big companies. They can invest in efficiency projects in Oregon. There's so many ways to make the program better that, you know, speaking for 2 minutes before a committee is pretty meaningless. But The concept is good. The implementation could be much better. If you got any questions, we've been dealing with this stuff for 25 years. I've made 10% of the solar water use in Oregon, and we save over 100 million kilowatt hours a year for our customers. We save $250,000 for schools with our lights. We've done projects under the ESDs. We're in many schools in Oregon. Just open for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? We appreciate your offer of help, and as always, we'll be open for any written material you care to share.
Oh, I've emailed you all, you know, rambling statement that I made.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. Thank you, colleagues, for staying a few minutes extra. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3582 and adjourn the committee on Joint Committee on Tax Credits.